Satire has its roots in Rome, most notably in the work of Horace and Juvenal. They don't practice satire as I've just defined it, but they do create the earliest templates. Horace came first. He started writing sometime around 30 BC. Horace talks about common foibles in bemused, "did you ever notice" terms, and also makes fun of himself. Here's how Chris Mackey describes Horace's tone. Chris is a professor in the Department of History and Classics at the University of Alberta.
For instance, one of Horace's satires is about how he's walking down the street one day when all of a sudden some guy comes up and wants to have an introduction from Horace to Maecenas, who's this kind of literary patron. The guy makes out that he's a budding poet too. And so the satire, to some extent, makes fun of Horace himself because of his ineffectualness in trying to make this guy who's clearly being a huge nuisance and won't be shaken off. So the satire is about Horace himself and his sort of lack of directness. But it also makes fun of sort of self-serving people who try to advance themselves by latching on to other people.
I'll be your mistress, Clitera.
Yes, in the vomitorium, recycling her breakfast.
Fetch her, me.
Fletcher who?
Get her now.
Huh?
Anscray.
Ah, eat ray, Senator. I'll dehydrate ray acne. Keep it limp, ray.
What a crude and unpleasant slave is he, ray. Perhaps the Greeks were right to kill their servants and wait upon themselves. Of course, we know their heads were in their stomachs and they had no need to eat. Eat, Nox Vomica. I'm hungry. Dare I eat this scroll? It's sheepskin, after all. Ah, but does contain a plot most distasteful to the Emperor.
Oh, God. No, that is no longer. Pox Domine.
Yes, and a pox upon your house, too, virtuous vagina clitora, famous wife of Mucus Bruto. Can we talk?
Barely, with all these slaves underfoot.
Were we deep in Greece, we'd eat them.
Prolongus, you're up with the cock.
Yes, I rose early.
Have you come to tryst again like we did last summer?
Gods, no. My head is in another place. And where's this household's head?
As always, down the hall, to the right. Still in bed.
Still in bed? When all of Roaming's in the streets to celebrate the Emperor's pre-victory parade and Bruto's yet abed?
Yet abed?
Yuck a puck.
But not yet asleep.
Ah.
Oh, Prolongus. He had a frightful night. He babbled like an open book, would tell a vision, then fall into his dreams again, back and forth, sweating like a Trojan. He slept the night away.
I'll be a horse's ass. What did he say?
I don't know if I should tell you.
Oh, come, come, vagina, be open with me.
Take it from the horse's mouth, dear partner.
Oh, Bruto.
For here I stand, stuffed like an anchovy with last night's capers.
Pimentos of the future?
I can't believe I dreamt the whole thing.
Your images make my mouth action for water. Let's eat.
Plethora, urethra, diarrhea, run to the kitchen. Let the food flow.
Are we alone?
No, I'm here.
Quick then, for time may spoil the meat of our plot. Tell me the omen in your entrails.
I cannot, though it sits on my stomach like a vulture.
Then pluck it. And with the feather, I'll tickle your throat, and you can throw it up to me.
I shall.
Oh, you shall? Well, I'll just stand over here and proceed.
I dreamt of Caliuga.
You dreamt of the Emperor? It must have been a nightmare.
Nay, more a night game.
What?
Torches illuminating a field of play. It was La Colosseum.
Who was fighting?
The senators and the angels.
Ah, just like now. And with our lions and Christians, too.
No, but a spectator said that the tigers had slaughtered the pirates there a week ago.
Ah, but Mucus, what of the Emperor?
He stood in the center of the field and supervised the raising of their standards while a female Nubian slave sang some foreign song of conquest. And everyone stood and held his hand over his purse. Then they all sat down, Save the Emperor.
Save the Emperor? Hardly a good omen.
Then amidst the very furor of the action, he stopped the games.
What?
Picked out a senator, raised his thumb high, and ejected him.
That's monstrous. And the people, of course, revolted.
No. No, they roared and showered him with the glittering tin bodies of their household gods. Some of them I recognized. Olympia. Old Bohemia. But Burgermeister? Der Pepper?
That a jerk with a thumb should have such power.
Yet there was a hopeful sign.
And that?
The crowd did not cry as here in roaming, long live the Emperor, but rather, kill him.
Kill him?
Master Rudolph! Master Rudolph! The Emperor's parade is passing!
We can but hope.
Come see! Come see! He's but a little league away!
That little man is breathing down our backs.
Because we're on our knees.
And knees must rise.
Like kneaded bread.
Suddenly.
And dump the ump.
We are agreed. Come, let us watch this Kali Yuga pass.
I'm coming.
You've been watching and hopefully listening to Chapter 13, Series 4, Part 2, Program 6 of Escaping from the Declining Fall of the Roaming Empire. This classical fiasco was made possible by a begrudged grant from USAC, US, UK, Litmus Industries, a short division of Burns Psychotic Plastic. This is Freddie Burns.
A century later, our second founding satirist comes along. He's Juvenal, the man considered the wellspring for modern satire. Juvenal is much more pissed off and exasperated. He rages about assorted irritants and frustrations. The target of his comic wrath is not us, but them.
Juvenal presents himself as someone who's completely outraged by what goes on around him, somebody who's sort of had this built-up anger about what he sees, and he kind of spills it out all of a sudden by giving vent to this rage that he has about what he sees. He doesn't actually attack specific individuals, but instead talks about characters who are representative of certain problems that he sees around him.
Flatus and Bruto, determined to bring about the Emperor Caliuga's downfall, have just joined the mandatory pre-victory festivities at the Emperor's table in the hall of the great cafeterium, as they anxiously await the fateful moment when they can fulfill their destiny.
Another blowfish, Bruto?
No, Fluto. By the great god Mercury, I'll pass.
Yes, I've been passing a lot myself. By Paluto, dog of the underguard, he's going to make us sing that barbarian tune again.
He leads us like a fool.
Yes, yes,
we must sing along.
He's lost his self-control.
Can't get us back alive. I just have to sit here and watch this Roman potboiler.
We're on. I just saw myself.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Hey, well, listen, good, then I can...
Attila was sitting on his hairy throne.
He's
I'm the Hun. I'm
he's
number
the one.
I said, come on, boys, let's hit the road to Rome.
He's
I'm the Hun. I'm number one. I say we'll rip us off some booty, then we'll come right back.
Son of a Hun, what have I done?
Oh, come on, let's back.
To the Hun. It's what the latest rage is to the Hun.
Come on, Hun.
It's from the Middle Ages. No other guest can touch it. No other holds a candle.
I learned it from a visitor
who learned it from a vandal to the Hun.
It's what the latest rage is,
screw the Hun. He's in his Middle Ages. No other girl will touch him. They'd rather use a candle.
Wait a minute. Stop it now. Who wrote these additional lyrics? All right.
Ah, he's getting on the table. This is our chance. Hand me the ketchup bottle.
Now, not now. Use your self-control.
I control the vertical. Watch me flip-flop. Ha-ha, Bisononi. I'm having a vision.
Well, then, tell us your vision. Come, Kali Yuga. Television. 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 Television.
I see a tower. What an eyeful. I'm going to build a tower of power. And I shall rise to the top and direct the building of great networks and broadcast them upon the waves. One voice, one image, one emperor, one me.
And one is nothing.
What? Who gives me such poor reception?
I, Flautus Prolongus.
And I, Macho Bruto.
A Congress of Senators.
A couple of eggheads come to scramble my vision.
Exactly. You poach the people's power.
And there's no gold left to lay another egg.
I'll lay anything I want. All hail, Kalyuga. I shall reign forever.
Hail and rain. The sky is falling, little chicken.
Bark, bark. Come on, team. Play ball with me.
We're calling your reign on account of your game. Take this.
You throw a salad on Caesar?
Dinner's on the emperor. Pass the ketchup, Heinz.
I bleed from 57 wounds. Et tu, Pluto. You lift your leg against me. I might as well be dead.
He's dead. The show's over. Long live the people. And now, at last, the wealthy and the powerful can speak for all.
Okay, Fred. You're on. I got the pliers jammed into the board.
The works of Horace and Juvenal weren't widely distributed in the modern sense. They were read aloud or declaimed in public, then copied by hand. But their works quickly became standard schoolboy texts, so both Roman satirists had a significant influence among the educated classes. Chris Mackey says that's particularly true of Juvenal.
So in terms of influence on modern works, it's clear from Juvenal how you can be engaging in the world around you in a sort of satirical in the sort of more generic sense of the word rather than satire in our sense. Since, after all, ancient satire doesn't really behave in the same way as what we think satire is. But more satire is a sort of somebody's view on the world around him, his notion that something isn't quite right, and commenting on the world around us, let's say. Whereas Juvenal is much more directly attacking what you think is wrong and pointing it out very specifically and mordantly.
I hate to bring this up and possibly derail this whole documentary. Yes, voice of nagging doubt in my head. What is it? Is it possible that what we're seeing today is not, in fact, a decline, but just a shift from one kind of satire to another? Could it be the case that satire is becoming less Juvenalian and more Horatian? No, I think I want to argue not that the jokes are becoming gentler or more Horatian, but that the enterprise of satire as a whole is becoming more difficult. If anything, the current climate is more venomous than ever. I'll buy that. So here's another question we may want to consider. Another question from the voice of nagging doubt in my head. What is it? Swift is the peak of the English tradition, but are we interested only in Western satire? Just the classics and some white Europeans? No, we're not. At the time Swift was writing, there was a culture a few thousand miles away where the middle class was much better read, where poets held considerable influence, and where nothing was off limits for satire. And it had been that way for hundreds of years.
So I'm Alexander Key, and I'm an assistant professor of Arabic and comparative literature at Stanford. If we look at the big swathe of Arabic intellectual history from 800 to 1800, and this is a geographical area that stretches from the Atlantic to Central Asia and down into India and up into Europe. But there's this one dominant intellectual language, which is Arabic, which people are using for literary production. So there's the space to move around, and that helps people who are doing things that we might now call satire.
So the view of, my working definition of satire, which is it's exaggerating behavior to highlight hypocrisy or self-aggrandizement or self-righteousness or pretense. Is that a recognizable kind of satire when you look at the literature of the Arab world in the period you've studied?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is an absolute constant across an entire millennium of literary and cultural history in Arabic and in Persian. But there's partly because the political power is dispersed, but also I think because of this point I keep making about language as the vehicle of power and literature as part of politics. This is a culture, or rather a set of cultures, that are all very comfortable with the use of language and the use of irony and the use of sarcasm and saying things that you don't, whilst meaning something slightly different. I mean, I think if you look at the way popular culture in the United States of America is operating today, there's a lack of comfort with irony. But for the Arabic language literary millennium, 800 to 1800, everybody knows that the game works with irony.
Wow. Let's make the traditional American statement here about what? We love the people of Islam.
Oh, we do.
We've got to say that.
Yeah.
We only don't look, we like
We don't
we
like the people of Islam
people.
Into
right.
buildings.
That's right.
And we like the people of Islam.
That's right.
Because that means peace.
This war is not a war against Islam or against the Muslim people.
This comedy is not about
No, it's not direct.
This is against.
This is not religious comedy.
No.
Let's make that very clear. This is not religious comedy.
The Fireside Theater is not a cult.
No.
Well, we were at one point a bad head cult.
Well, yes.
But
all
I
right.
think people have been
here.
Killed.
Here is the bad.
I don't know. I think we are a cult. I'm sorry.
Well, we're a nice cult.
There are these guys taking movies of us. I'm worried.
Here's
know.
Some
don't
com-
do anything we say.
Here's some comedy vitamins in this irony deficient times.
These would seem to be the perfect conditions for satire, and in fact, that combination of a diverse population, a common literary language, and an understanding of irony gives satirists a lot of room to maneuver.
And what this produces is everything is up for satire. Like, everything. Like, there are no real sacred cows that no one ever satirizes. So there's satire of the Quran. There's satire of religion. I mean, there's one of the most famous canonical Arabic poets, Abu Nawas, has a poem about having sex with young man, in which the entire, well, it's not really a poem, but it's like a brief dialogue about having sex with young men and how great it is. And the whole thing is, so it's a series of direct quotes from the Quran kind of reorganized to make a poem about how fun sex is.
At times of dexterity like this, my wee native compendium, Mohammed, used to pray to the divinities, his little brown froggy body a-quiver at my loins, chanting a stream of ancient Egyptian holograms.
What?
Diaphragms.
No.
I used to date...
Hieroglyphs, that's it. Do you remember any? Will they help? Anything
yes,
at all?
Of course. Let's see, it was a jackal-headed woman with her eyes akimbo, a king sitting sideways on his throne, a drip with gold, chipped nose uplifted, thusly... All engraven on a pyramid of massy size, with the body of a lion, paws that refreshes, a tale told by an idiot, and the head of a fox.
The pyramid is opening.
Which one?
The one with the ever-widening hole in it.
I'm saved! I'm going in!
No, don't do that, son! It's dark and dirty in there!
Oh, but Mom!
It's full of bees and spiders! You might poke your eye out when your father comes home!
I'm going in, Mom!
And again, you know, this doesn't, you know, Abu Nawas doesn't get locked up for this.
Unlike the other work we've talked about, the satire of the Arabic language millennium was widely distributed. Medieval Damascus alone had 30 to 40 small libraries, each of which was on par with the biggest libraries in Europe at the time. So the final piece of the puzzle was distribution, which combined with literary and political culture to support a flowering of satire that lasted for centuries. Sinclair Lewis, the first American to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. His career can be split into two dramatically different periods. Lewis wrote some of his most acclaimed and influential novels in the 1920s, including Babbitt and Elmer Gantry. Here's satire professor Terry Matheson.
Babbitt was a pretty searing indictment of middle-class conservatives, business-oriented. Babbitt is crass. He's relatively uneducated. He can't understand why his son is going to – or his daughter is going to university where she has to study English and sociology and things that don't bring home any money, where she should be taking practical things that will result in a better job, where we've certainly heard that before. And yet deep down, he says to his one good friend, Paul – he says, "I've done everything I'm supposed to do, and yet for some reason I don't feel satisfied." And of course, the irony there is that the reason he's not satisfied is precisely because he's tried to do everything he is "quote unquote" supposed to do.
Here they come in their hell for leather golf carts.
The street people
terrifying their own children, living in a world only they can understand.
They'll bug you. They'll bug your mind.
The street people.
You'll see them in breakfast nooks across the country, smoking cigarettes, drinking martinis, driving two cars.
The street people.
You'll join them, hanging out at redemption centers, licking glue, making deals with total strangers.
The street people.
You'll be inside their minds as they say...
Anything more from the supermarket, honey?
More sugar!
The street people. Now playing in patios and parking lots everywhere from Paranoid Pictures.
This movie has been rated X the Unknown. Positively no one admitted.
Babbitt sounds like a Gulliver figure 200 years later. Lewis's novel so perfectly captured this character type that the words Babbitt and Babbittry entered the popular lexicon. His next novel, the religious satire Elmer Gantry, also made a huge splash.
Is it going to be all right?
It's going to be all right!
Oh, you bet! Dear friends, it is going to be all right. It's going to be all right tonight. Here at the Powerhouse Church of the Presumptuous Assumption of the Blinding Light.
Oh, blinding light, oh, light that blinds, I cannot see, look out for me.
Yes, friends, welcome to Pastor Flash's Hour of Reckoning. With Organ Leroy at his organ again. And the 50 voice St. Louis Aquarium Choir. I'm Deacon E.L. Mouse, but dear friends, in these days of modern time, when you can't tell the ACs from the DCs, well, aren't we all yearning for someone who can turn on a little stopping power? Dear friends, I mean a smoky glass. Don't you think I mean a lightning rod with which to chase these spooks away? Don't you know I mean our own pastor, Rod Flash? He's been up for a week, but he's coming down.
All of the conditions for satire seem to be present. Then came the crash of 1929, when the Babbitts lost their fortunes, started throwing themselves out of windows. The game had changed. Lewis wrote very little satire after that, although his 1935 classic, It Can't Happen Here, is considered semi-satirical. So can we generalize, based on the career of Sinclair Lewis, can we conclude that overall prosperity is a condition for satire?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think it gets into the point of what historical periods does satire tend to flourish? And I can't speak for the whole of human history, but I know that in the 18th century, Alexander Pope, the great poet and who knew Swift, as a matter of fact, and I remember reading somewhere that there was a rising middle class during that period, and these people had money, they were reasonably well educated, and they had some leisure time, and they wanted to be able to read. And Pope translated classical literature and made it very readable for these people, and he made a ton of money on it. So it suggests that the society that produced a Pope and a Swift was a fairly affluent one. Same thing with the 1920s. The 20s were a period of – it was just after the war. There was a great deal of loosening of public mores. There was a lot of wealth circulating. The economy appeared to be strong. Of course, it was resting on a very shaky foundation. But that produced some great satire, not just Sinclair Lewis, but I think Shaw wrote some of his better – plays during that period.
Just to keep her still for a moment, you name Bradshaw.
Yeah.
What Brad stand for?
Bernard.
Oh! Oh my gosh! You, George Bernard Shaw! Oh. Famous author and literary smart guy!
Oh, you figured all out!
I see, boss! Bradshaw say many times he on the side of right!
That's right!
That because he writer!
Huh?
In obvious pun lies subtle secret Rodonato. Writer responsible for all problems he creates.
Wait a minute, Fooge. You're not going to go pinning this monster rap on me.
I've said before, Trump is his own entertainer. He sees himself primarily as an entertainer. He's concerned about ratings. So he'll draw attention to poll results or economic figures or how much coverage there is in the press or on the media for something he said or did. It's all about how much he is the subject of the conversation, which is what, you know, most entertainment media is about.
For here comes that daredevil dandy himself, Frank Acme Jr. in his high-toned yellow runabout. I'll just work my way down to the... getting out of the car with young Frank is the celebrated English crime stopper, Hemlock Stone.
Frank, can you tell us what's going on inside?
I can, but I can't.
Can the Acme stock stand the slaughtering? It's getting in the market. Okay.
We'll bull through it.
Tell me, Mr. Stones, have you got a statement for the radio listeners?
Yes, I'm quite jazzed to be here in Chicago, the home of the vacuum flapper, pig oil beer, and the Zeppelin chew.
This is the microphone here.
Oh, I see, instrument. Yes. And here's a special hello to its new owner, I'm sure he's listening, that twisted genius who should be beneath all this, the electrician.
Mr. Stone? Who's he, and how's he connected with this case?
Excuse me, Mr. Stones, but we mustn't keep Dad and his police waiting.
Quite right, Frank. But I would like to say...
Boys, that ought to give you all enough to chew on, boys.
What's he going to do now? What do you think of American girls?
They're both going inside now, and what a shocker this is. That dynamo of detective energy has switched some new light on current events, sparking the positive hope that he's going to run the negative force to ground. Wow. And now, while we're waiting for something to happen here, we return to the Cubist Lounge, the sophisticated music of the Hotel Vermouth, for Pig Lewis and his continental cocktail. Are we off, Joe?
I am so worldwide, I want to wear a death's head and nail myself to a tree.
I want to spread disease around the globe by phone.
I want to own your water rights and sell them to myself.
We're the people at USPlus.news. If there's a news drought, we'll throw gasoline.
And light the fuse.
Oh, over the world, we've got you covered.
We're cinching you tighter to people whose names you can't even pronounce.
Globalization, that's the game with no name, and you're in charge when you're with us.
US.PlusNews.
A slogan in itself.
Misunderstood and angry.
Fair and balanced.
So he's the entertainer, which means then that, you know, professional entertainers are kind of stuck because they're out of a role, really. Plus, I suppose the general, and I think people all sides of the political debate would probably agree that things are just so extraordinary at the moment that it's impossible to come up with a fictional version of what's happening that isn't as extraordinary as what is actually happening. So, you know, reality is much more interesting than any fictional version or fictional commentary on reality, I suppose.
I've been trying to work out what is it or what are the elements that make him difficult to satire, unsatirizable.
Bring me shame, can nothing. Bring me shame, I never know why. Bring me shame, can nothing. Bring me shame, I said. Bring me shame, can nothing. Bring me shame, it's pointless to try. said, because I'm 43 bumper stickers and a YOLO license plate.
Yeah. What sorts of conditions or agreements do you think have to be in place for satire to be possible?
Well, satire is always about, or comedy generally, I suppose it's about exaggeration, distortion, a bending of the truth. But then if you have someone who does that anyway as a kind of default, you know, he's adopted to the rules that are there really for the subversives. You know, he's his own subversive. And actually then makes you realize how much political comedy relies on there being an agreed code of conduct so that you can have a go at people who breach that code of conduct. But if someone is coming with their own code of conduct, you know, and are just ignoring the perceived norms of how you go about being president of the United States, then it's like, you know, you started off playing one game that you all agreed the rules to, game of football or something, and then someone else has come along and has decided to bring the rules of boxing to this football match,
right,
and abandon the football rules, you know.
And the Locusts threaten to score late in the game.
Cadiz,
number 8, a floater up from the Grapefruit Leagues. Nick Cadiz floating up to the plate. Aquila eyes him. He's hungry for this out. Here comes the windup. The pitch. And Cadiz splits open the back of his uniform and another insect crawls out and flies away. Looks like a beautiful butterfly. Wait, a beautiful butterfly has just emerged from the back of Caterpillar. And the outfield is going to raise him. Even Quacko Suidai is punching up this Locust team in right field. But wait a minute, fans. Wait a minute. The Locust eggs are starting to hatch. Looks like a million Locusts emerging behind the home plate. Aquila in the air, diving now, dodging, grabbing these Locusts. Hold it! Hold it, fans, hold it! Lepus has just been eaten by Lupus, and they're on the same team. This is unprecedented, as it's all out warfare going on the field.
Except it's not that, because in that circumstances you could just switch to conforming to the rules of boxing, but it's his own form of boxing. You know, there's no Marquess of Queensbury rules. It's just the Donald Trump rules, which is you can hit anybody anywhere for any reason or indeed no reason.
As this memorable broadcast from the Pissgarten Olympic Auditorium in Hochstaffel, Bavaria, a blistering day in August 1932. 23. The exciting scene of the first famous sports broadcast, the Schmeling Herring Fist Fest.
I'm in the back of this great big auditorium where the great big white man and the great big black man are training a tremendous series of great big punches. Oh, and Herring's down in the sauce. The white man is down and the German is up and they're raining terrific blows on the black man. Now they're pummeling the gypsies. and the Jews, oh, band of brothers! And here comes the Spanish air farce. Oh, it looks like a rehearsal for the Final Solution. Oh, those Spanish flyboys are so sexy. Schmeling is circling, but now the referee, a feisty little fellow with a funny-looking mustache, he's stopping the fight. He's raising his right arm in a stiff salute for silence. Oh. Everyone in the hall is doing the duck. I mean, doing the same.
Sigfried!
I think they're all asking to leave the room. So it appears from Biscarton Hall that round one goes to the Jerrys.
Man, was that exciting.
Peter Cook had that phrase of how much he admired the, you know, the subversive cabaret in Weimar Germany in the 1930s and how it did so much to stop the rise of Hitler. You know, it doesn't, if you think that just telling jokes against those you dislike is going to stop them, then you've got another thing coming. It doesn't work like that. And you know, if you really want to argue against someone's political opinion, then argue against them. You know, go out, campaign, write, you know, join a political party or a campaign group or whatever. But writing jokes isn't going to stop them.
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he? Where could that man be? We looked around, and then we found the man for you and me. Pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Rhineland's a fine land once more. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Watch out, Europe. We're going on tour. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Look, it's springtime.
Winter for Poland and France. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Wolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Well, I never. Talk about bad taste.
Come on, let's get out of here before they kill us.
Heil Hitler! Heil Hitler!
myself. Hail to me. I'm the crowd who's out to change our history. Hail myself. Raise your hand. There's no greater dictator in the land. Everything I do for you. If you're looking for a war, here's World War II. Hail myself. Raise your beer. Every hotsy-totsy Nazi stand and cheer.